you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 133 of The Law Entrepreneur. As usual, it's me, Neil Tyra, your host. And today I'm delighted to have somebody that I consider an attorney who should be on the Mount Rushmore of early technology adopters, somebody who's written about being a solo practitioner for years on her blog, myshingle.com, and that's none other than Carolyn Elefant. Now, Carolyn, as you will hear, is an attorney who's had a solo practice here for a good long while and still a thriving practice still here in Washington, D.C. But what she's perhaps most known for outside of that legal community or the industry that she supports in the legal space is, her, as I said, her blog, myshingle.com. And the books that she's written. And, you know, I consider her to be, you know, part of that group that are path setters, people like Ernie Svensson and Nicole Black. Nicole is the lady that she wrote her book with, as you'll hear, Lisa Solomon, Chelsea Lambert, all of those people that I've had on the show already. Ernie, Lisa, Chelsea, and Nicole have already been on the show. I've been wanting to have Carolyn on for a long time. For a number of different reasons, we weren't able to make it happen, but today we were. So I am thrilled to be able to share some conversation that I had with my new friend, Carolyn Elefant. Carolyn Elefant, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you.
Well, I am delighted to have you here. I feel, you know, in the course of doing this show, I've had the opportunity to talk to what I would say is solo and small firm royalty along the way. People like the early pioneers, Ernie Svensson, Chelsea Lambert is another one name that comes to mind, Lisa Solomon, and Nicole Black. You know, one of the people that I've been looking forward to talking to for a long time is yourself, Carolyn Elefant. So tell our audience what I already know about who you are and how you got to be where you are today.
Okay, sure. So my name's Carolyn Elefant. I own a small law firm in Washington, D.C., and also practice in Maryland, New York. And my firm focuses on renewable energy and pipelines and eminent domain. So I call it power, pipelines, and property. I also blog at myshingle.com, which is the longest running blog on solo and small firm practice. It's going on 16 years in December. And I'm the author of Solo by Choice and also co-author of Social Media for Lawyers. Solo by Choice is a book on starting and running a modern law practice, and the social media book is obviously about lawyers using social media.
So, you know, as I said, I think of you as solo royalty because when I first started my practice many, many years ago, one of the first blogs that I read consistently was yours and Ernie's. And I would have to say a lot of whatever success that I had starting out as a solo practitioner was following suggestions and viewpoints of people like the two of you. So I had your book. I have how to start and build a law practice by, is it Feinberg's?
Feinberg, yeah.
Yeah. Those were the two books that kind of I used as my reference Bible. So that's great. So now you're still practicing law. I mean, the whole business of writing and doing more as a kind of an offline coaching personality hasn't overtaken your law practice.
No, I mean, at different phases of my career, I've done sort of more or less writing. You know, years ago when my daughters were young, I worked less. So I was more time constrained and I probably didn't take on as many cases in my firm. But, you know, now my daughters are out of the house. And so I feel like I have enough time to do both things. Yeah. So, and I find the writing, you know, the writing and the blogging is not, it's enjoyable time for me. So in many ways it's, you know, if somebody has a hobby like knitting or sewing, the blogging is more like that.
You know, I'm going to ask you a question that stumped me when I was asked this question. It was from Megan Hargroder, who is a guest of ours. On our post recording, you know, chat, she asked me a question about, you know, practicing law versus podcasting. And a lot of people say, which do you like better? Which do you enjoy more? But she asked me a different question. She said, which do you see yourself doing longer? And I had to admit, I'd never contemplated that before. So I'm going to ask you, which do you see yourself doing longer, practicing law or writing and contributing to the knowledge base of running a solo practice?
That is a very good question. I mean, I guess I've always been of the view that people should have multiple careers. And in fact, I just went to my 30th law school reunion this past summer. And for a while, I'd been thinking about looking at other areas of study. And so when I think of what I'm doing in a professional career, it isn't necessarily law full time. And I guess I do think of myself as continuing to write or comment on the legal profession, because that would be the easiest way to keep a foot in the door, even if I went off in some different direction professionally.
Well, let's talk a little bit just about your practice itself. Have you always been a solo firm, or did you start off in a different type of setting?
So I started off, during my second summer in law school, I worked at Big Law, a big law firm in the New York, New Jersey area. And unfortunately for me, I was a very good associate, which I discovered just means you just get more work. So
and longer hours.
Right. The two good associates were the ones who were always there, and the other 10 or 12 were, you know, going to the bars after, you know, leaving at 6. So I felt kind of burnt out after law school. So I decided, instead of taking an offer at the firm, to just come down to Washington and work for the government for a while. So I worked for this agency called Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, because by the time I decided that, a lot of the more, you know, sort of plum jobs like the Honors Program at Justice or some of the other departments had already been filled. So I spent a year and a half at FERC, which is the agency. Then I went to work for a small energy firm. And then I also did some work for a larger energy firm. And I started my own practice, I guess, like around the beginning of 1994. And when I started, it was because my firm had downsized. And at that time, I was doing all energy and I wasn't really in court a lot. And I knew I wanted to get more litigation experience. So I started my firm and I did some energy work. The energy work always paid the bills. I was able to do contract work for other attorneys, but it was at a much higher rate than document review. Of course, back then, document review was paying well.
Right.
And then I did, you know, civil litigation. I did court-appointed work in D.C. just to get more trial experience. And I've always done appeals. So originally, when I started my firm, it was just as a placeholder. The economy picked up and I started getting requests for interviews. And at that time, I was pregnant with my daughter. And when these big firms started talking about, you know, 50-hour weeks and how that was, you know, pretty moderate, I was just like, no, I don't want to do that. And so I always say that I started solo because I didn't really have much of a choice, but I stayed with my own firm because of family, the decision.
Yeah. You know,
of having kids.
No, it's interesting. Now, was entrepreneurship in your family background, is that something that you came to easily, or did you kind of learn that as you went along as well?
So I always thought I would, when I was in elementary school, my dad was not an entrepreneur. He was a chemist. He worked for a pharmaceutical company that manufactured gum, and he would bring all these samples home, which I would sell in school when I was like 10 years old under the table. And so I learned about business because, you know, my dad got the gum, but he didn't get it for free. So he made me, you know, pay him, I guess, the wholesale rate. And I realized, you know, I have to sell it at the retail rate to make my profit.
That's hysterical.
Yeah. So I did that. And then when I was in law school, I started a resume writing and cover letter service. In law school, after that job at Big Law, I bought a Mac back in 1987. This was before people had computers, so they would go to Kinko's or, you know, to a professional company to do their resumes. So I just decided to undercut Kinko's, and I did resumes for people during law school. So I ran this resume and cover letter service. I discovered Mail Merge. I could do, you know, like 40 cover letters. And I guess people thought I was separately typing each cover letter, but I charge $1 per letter. And, you know, they'd come rolling off the printer, and I'd be like, you know, this $10, $20, $30, $40. I'd make feet up on the desk, and it was just like, ka-ching, ka-ching.
So literally, so, you're printing money.
Yeah. It felt like that. So,
so just as a quick aside here, this is 87, did you say? Thereabouts?
Yeah, it's the 87, 88. I graduated in 88.
That would be a Mac like 512?
It was, I think the model above, no, it may have been the 512. I unfortunately, after I brought the Mac with me when I started working, and I used it after hours, when I was at home, but my apartment had this a pipe burst when I was away for the weekend, and the Mac like was destroyed, and I just got rid of it. Yeah. So I don't have it to check, but I think it was the 512. It had the floppy disk. Yeah. If your listeners know what a floppy disk is.
Not too many anymore.
Yeah, it was the little one too, the little square.
3.5 inch.
Right.
Hard
right.
Floppies. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So we went from 128 to 512 to the Mac Plus, which was a whopping one megabyte of memory. And we thought that was all we'd ever need.
I know.
Now we have terabytes of memory.
right. It's like your phone has more power than that.
Oh, Mac. Yeah.
So.
Without question. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight. Daylight is the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to manage my practice. If you're feeling swamped trying to keep track of cases and clients, but you don't want to pay the hefty price tag of something like Salesforce or other legal-specific tools, I recommend you give Daylight a look. Daylight helps me prioritize my day. It helps me keep track of my clients, cases, documents, emails, calendars, to-dos, and reminders, all in one place. The case management part of Daylight makes it really easy to organize all the details and work for each case so things are done on time. The best part of Daylight is that it lets you work offline. You don't need an internet connection to pull up case details or info about a client like with other CRMs and case management tools. And new in Daylight is their Zapier integration, so you can automate things like pulling new leads from a contact form on your website right into Daylight. And for techies like me, you know that integration with tools like Zapier is really fundamental to making something like Daylight work the way you want it to work. So to learn how Daylight can help you grow your practice, visit marketcircle.com/daylight. And be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first month subscription. That's Daylight by Market Circle. The legal environment is more competitive than ever, and small law firms are feeling the pinch. With over 1.3 million attorneys in the United States and counting, it can be hard to stand out from the crowd. And that's why Spotlight Branding helps lawyers become unforgettable. Spotlight Branding is a different kind of internet marketing company. They don't put their clients on the SEO hamster wheel, and they don't ask them to burn thousands of dollars on speculative pay-per-click advertising. Instead, they're focused on the fundamentals of legal marketing that have worked for dozens upon dozens of years. They use the internet to build a premium brand for solo and small firm lawyers like myself, and they put systems in place to create top-of-mind awareness, allowing their clients to maximize the referrals and repeat business. It's the smart way to grow your law firm. To get more information, visit spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, and receive a special gift from our friends there at Spotlight Branding. Spotlight Branding, helping lawyers become unforgettable. All right, so you had the entrepreneurial spirit straight from the jump, and you started your practice by necessity. So tell us about the early days. How did you cope? Did you go get the lease for the office space and hope the clients would show up? Or did you work from the kitchen table? Or how did you start your practice?
So back then, there was really a paucity of information about starting a firm. There was the Funberg book, which I didn't feel was completely applicable to my circumstances because a lot of the marketing advice was very much geared at somebody who was starting a general practice. And I knew that I wanted to try to leverage some of my energy law.
And corporate connections.
Right. And the DC Bar offered a program on starting a firm, but that was really back then, you know, the people who presented at it, you know, the woman had basically been at a partner at a big firm. And when she decided to start her own firm, she took an associate, she took a paralegal, you know, she just said, you've got to have like $30,000 to get started. And I was sort of like, you know,
yeah, that's not my situation either.
Right. Not going to work. So I I remember it was in the back of the Washington Bar magazine. They used to have these ads for virtual office space. And so I had at 601 Pennsylvania Avenue had this beautiful virtual space. It overlooked Pennsylvania Avenue. It was Pennsylvania Avenue address. And so I used that. And then I, you know, either worked from home or worked from a library, and I would meet with clients in that space. And I mean, even back then, you know, people were very impressed. They were like, Pennsylvania Avenue, that's right. So fancy.
Yeah.
So
again, you're ahead of your time there, because now that is kind of a scenario that tons and tons of attorneys use: virtual office space with a great address and, you know, great amenities, but they don't really work there that often, myself included.
Right. And there's even now, there are so many, you know, there's all those co-working spaces, right, where, you know, you can get, like, even if you want to work out of your house every day, you can get a hot desk for just, you know, a little bit more than what, it probably comparable to what I paid for that virtual space, because I think it was like $150 a month. But again, it was like 20 years ago. You know, now you can get a hot desk for $300.
You're 100% correct. Yep.
Yeah. And you can go there every day if, you know, if you want, just, you know, usually if you get in early. And I knew about this. I right now, I have a dedicated office in a WeWork space, but when I have summer associates or associates, I just, you know, get them hot desks, and which they prefer. You know, this is funny, they actually prefer that to office space. I offered to have them get their own office, and they're like, no, you know, we like working in this open environment. So
here you are, you start your practice, and you get this fancy address on Pennsylvania Avenue, a few blocks up from the White House. And how'd you go about telling your potential client base that you were open for business?
So I know that I sent letters out to, you know, to a lot of the people who were in my Rolodex. I took one very teeny tiny client from my law firm with me, but, you know, and then I took court appointed work, and, you know, I would talk to people in the lounge in Superior Court. There's a lawyer's lounge, and, you know, once in a while, I get referrals from those attorneys, but it was very word of mouth. Oh, I remember one thing that I did even back then. I had one of the clients I had worked with at my firm was developing a new type of energy technology to harness electricity from the ocean. And it raised a lot of unique regulatory issues that I had done a lot of work on when I was at the firm. And as I was on my way out, I wrote a law review article that was published. And so when I started my firm, I got a list of people who might be interested in that area. And I called them and asked if I could send them a copy. I have, you know, like 50 or 75 right. of those little pamphlets. And I called, you know, like 50 people. And it wasn't awkward though, because I had something to offer them, right. you know, and I could use it as excuse. So that was another way that I got the word out. And that eventually led to a couple of ocean energy clients. Honestly, I was priced out of a lot of the bar events, you know, the specialty bar events in my industry. And so by necessity, I started going to industry events, not realizing that, oh, this is a good idea to go where the clients are, not where the other lawyers are. So I would go to, you know, events sponsored by like the Marine Technology Society, or I think there was some other, like some hydro developers, Developers Trade Association. So I would go to those types of events to meet.
But isn't it interesting that you know, when you had your law review article and you sent that out, you're actually doing content-based marketing and value-based marketing, what we call that today. And we say today, you have to have something of value to give to prospective clients to show them that you know what you're talking about and to pique their interest and use it as a tool to develop a relationship. And that's exactly what you were doing way back when. And the same is true about, you know, going where the client is. You know, that's now kind of standard relationship building 101. But when you were doing it, that's not what people did.
Right. But it just, I guess, it made a lot of sense. And like I said, part of it, I wish I could say it was my brilliant insight, but like I said, I was just priced out of some of those events. I could go to the Marine Technology Society and for $20, I could get like a catered lunch and sit at a table of potential clients versus paying $100 to go to, you know, a bar happy hour.
The bar happy hour and talk to other attorneys who don't have a whole lot to offer you in the first place. So that's fascinating.
Your
practice has been bubbling along ever since. And I know that, you know, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the Washington, D.C. law market, I mean, Carolyn's firm is highly thought of. And you mentioned you do a lot of appellate work now. So you work in, the second most important court in the land.
I've argued before Judge Kavanaugh, and I actually had a case where bizarrely, I represented a co-petitioner with a client represented by Chief Justice Roberts.
Yeah.
So I worked with him on a case, and I didn't realize how well known he was at the time. I was giving him a lot of advice, and he was very nice.
Gracious. So somewhere along the line, then, while you're developing this practice and raising a family, you start, you know, in essence, putting pen to paper and writing about it. How did that come about?
So, you know, as I said, when I started a firm, there was so little information for somebody in my position. And I really enjoyed what I was doing, and it was very disturbing to me that people weren't made aware of more options. And what really ticked me off was that, you know, many of the women who I went to law school with, who were far better students than me, they were on law review, they worked at big firm jobs, and as soon as they got pregnant with their first kid, they left the law, and it seemed like such a waste. They just, nobody was telling them that there was this other amazing option that you could avail yourself of. So I wrote, the first article I wrote about a practice was actually right before I had my oldest daughter. And it was the Washington Legal Times used to have like a solo column or something. And so I wrote it for the Legal Times, and it was published. And I published a couple of other things with Legal Times, or over the next couple of years.
But in those days, you wrote the article, you submitted it to them, and hoped that they published it.
Yes, you mailed it in. There was
it was hard copy.
Well, I know that, you know, in 1993 or 94, I was able to use email because teaching a paralegal class at University of Maryland, and they had email, but the problem was nobody else had it. So it didn't matter.
Because I know that for people who wrote, I wrote in a different community at that time, and you would send your manuscript, in the mail and hope that it got published and really hope that it didn't get stolen.
Right. That's true. That was definitely a concern. So, and I guess when I started my blog, originally, you know, the sort of the first wave of the web and .com was like around 1999, 2000, where you had like all these, a million websites popping up, and you heard all these stories about, you know, the 20-year-olds with the business plan on the napkin, and they made millions of dollars for, you know, like petfood.com or something. And I just kept trying to think of a kind of site that I could start. So my initial idea was to start sort of a site like that was everything solo and small firm that would, you know, have a variety of perspectives on solo and small firm practice and would, you know, sell products for solos and small firms. I thought that maybe there would be a way for them to, you know, to share pleadings or to aggregate purchases. So,
you wanted to leverage the community and allow your community members to force multiply between themselves.
Right. And I couldn't, I just couldn't come up with a way to get it developed. I went on Elance and I did hire a developer from like Bosnia or Serbia or somewhere. Right. It just didn't quite get it right. And so I just, you know, I didn't have a lot of money on hand at the time. And there was a very technical website called Slashdot, which made its code available. The site was Slashdot. It made the underlying code called Slashcode available. And my husband was a big fan of Slashdot. And so there's this, a book finally came out to explain how to install the code because it was very complicated. And so he suggested that I just use that as a platform, which originally, you know, I wasn't that thrilled about it, but it was free and it was available. And, you know, and so that's how I got started. And by the time I started my blog, which was at the end of 2002, and it took me like months, I put all these resources on it. I mean, it took a lot, you know, and I learned how to use the code too, and, you know, make it look the way I wanted to, but it went out at 2002. And by then, you know, like, you know, Ernie Svensson and Denise Howell, Howard Bashman, there were already sort of a an early group of lawyers who were blogging and who were just doing it to share information, to do it free without like a, you know, a business model for making money from it. So I sort of just got pulled up in that wave, and I kind of assumed, you know, at that time I just couldn't figure out a way to really make money off it directly.
But in the end, you were amongst the leaders and you had a blog that was started to generate traffic and eyeballs looking at it. And, you know, it's, to me, I think of your blog, and by the way, let's plug the name,
myshingle.com.
You know, it was part of that early groundswell of blog development that marked, you know, a sea change in how information was shared. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. So, and to say you really rolled your own is really 100% accurate, because no two blogs were really technically the same in the underpinnings of them, the code that allowed them to work. So you had to become a software engineer and a writer.
Yeah, everything. Yeah, there was nothing very standard about the different platforms at that time.
But of course, now you have these plug and play platforms, and so it mm-hmm. is completely different. You can start a blog, in 5 minutes.
You can,
as opposed to 5 years.
right.
worth of work. So tell us a little bit then about how the blog could continue to succeed. I mean, you wrote on just every subject imaginable relative to solo firms and small firms, the business side, the legal side, the emotional side, the time management aspects. I mean, you name it, you've written on it.
Yeah, so it was never, I realized from the beginning that the really hardcore tech stuff was not going to be my forte. Yeah. Back then, technology was really, like Tabs or Amicus and all these desktop-based, hot docs platforms that you needed consultants for. And so you would hire somebody like a Ross Codner.
To install it. Yeah.
Right. Taylor. Yeah. And to sort of set the system up, or you had an IT person on staff. And I knew that was beyond my bailiwick. I mean, I was, of course, using technology, but I wasn't using a Mac then, but I was using a PC, and that's how I was, I may have had some very simple program for, keeping track of contacts or something. So I knew that tech was not going to be the focus. And I also didn't really want to do something that was very nuts and boltsy, because I felt that there was, a lot of information about, just like, how to manage a trust account or things like that. So I would cover those topics, but I also wanted to talk about, ethics issues unique to solos, whether solos and small firms were disproportionately disciplined, and just look at, the role of women lawyers and women-owned firms, and sort of look at solo and small firm lawyers in the broader context of the legal profession. And I also wanted to, highlight and celebrate solo and small firm lawyers' accomplishments. So it was always about a lot more than just practice management, right, which after a while can become repetitive. I mean, there are always, new iterations of products, but, after a while it just all runs together. So I think it's because I had this broad scope to begin with that, is why it was able to keep going, because there was always a constant influx of, new ideas and new information. Of course, all the changes in the law and in the tools that lawyers are using, the evolution of social media and, online video and things like that. So there are always topics to cover.
And it's interesting, you don't shy away from calling solos out. There have been a few of your posts that take solos to task for not owning their own behavior or their own ethics or their own approach to the practice. I think that's really beneficial to the community.
Yeah, I mean, one point of the blog too was, I really wanted it to help make solos and small firm lawyers more effective lawyers who could, deliver better quality of legal service to the public. And, and so part of it is, highlighting situations where their ethics faux pas. At the same time, I will also call out regulators when I think that a bar rule is stupid. I mean, I know I've written at least once or twice about a solo practitioner who, had like an extra $100 in the trust account and, got sanctioned for it. So, that to me just seems to be ludicrous.
By the same token, you've also taken solos to task. If you don't know how to manage your trust account, find somebody who does.
Right. Yes, yeah. That's true too.
So, so technology changes so fast, and now there's more to life than just writing a blog. you know, what kind of new ideas, new concepts do you have for your writing, and where do you see that going?
So I have been, that's very interesting, because I have noticed, or I just have this sense that in some way blog readership is declining a little bit, just not necessarily my blog per se, but just overall, because there's just so much content out there. You can't spend, you take you days to go through, you know, all of the articles at your favorite blog.
Well, the data says that we just don't read as much.
Really? That's interesting. I had not seen
that. We don't read as much as many books. We don't read as many magazines. We don't nobody gets magazines. We don't read blogs that much. We'll read stuff online, but we better be able to read it in 2 minutes or less.
Right, right. So that's one thing I've started doing. So I'm trying to look at ways to, you know, repurpose my content or make it, you know, more usable. I've started posting on, I've always linked to my blog posts on Twitter with a little bit of a summary. I don't know if people actually read the post, but I think they at least read the summary. I mean, that's one way to get the word out. And I've been doing that on, you know, Instagram and Facebook. I've also thought about aggregating some of the content, you know, by theme. So I might have like sort of like an aggregated ebook on, you know, ethics issues in the digital age, or I've had one series called Make Money Mondays, each Monday, like sort of a unique marketing idea. I thought about just like putting all those together, because I think that, you know, sometimes people may, you know, read, just sit down and read everything at once. I've thought a little bit about video. I mean, a lot of people ask me about podcasting, and I really feel like the field is somewhat saturated. I mean, there's so many really great podcasts, and then there are also many not great podcasts where people just kind of ramble, or it's like Inside Baseball for an hour, which I don't really like listening to those. So I don't know if I would really do a podcast. Not sure about video. I've been experimenting with very short video clips, like 1 minute lessons.
Yeah. Well, it's all very exciting, because I mean, I think that you've got so much content, and there's so many opportunities, so many pathways that you might go with it. Do you ever see yourself going back and updating your books, or do you update them on a regular basis?
So the first edition of Solo by Choice came out in 2008, and then I updated it for 2011. And since then, I have really had it on my agenda to do at least one final version. Each time I do it, you know, I feel like there's things to add. The last edition is it's not outdated per se. I worked with a publisher who is also an editor, and he was very good about trying to ferret out stuff that would become stale. Because if I'd written it myself, I probably would have, you know, written about things like, you know, use Google Plus, or, you know, use
my, these MySpace.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. And so when you don't have that much detail, it can at least eliminate some of the staleness. But I feel like, you know, in 2008, when I wrote the book, I wrote it because I wanted people to understand the option of solo. And at that time, that was the 2008 version came out right before the market crashed. Right. And so people were still working at big firms, and nobody really wanted that option. 2011, the economy was still down. I wrote it like 2010, it came out in 11. And so the tone was sort of like, you know, if you want to stay in the law, here's your chance. And now I feel like solo, I mean, I feel like the opportunities are endless. You could start a practice, a legal tech company, you could do both, you could do everything, you know, so I wanted to kind of have that tone. So it is, I am going to update that. The social media for lawyers, I mean, I co-authored that with Nicole Black. And, you know, again, a lot of the sites we wrote about are, you know, I mean, even the screenshots are outdated, but the ABA has been putting out these, you know, sort of pocket guides on social media. So I don't know if there's a need for like a comprehensive book that like the one we put together.
Yeah. Well, you guys, you know, you were the Mount Rushmore of writers at the time regarding social media, you and Nicole. There's a lot of validation in what you've done. And so I think the audience would be willing to listen again if you wanted to say something something new.
Yeah, well, working with Nicole was actually very good. She's a very fast writer, so it forced me to not
screw around. Yeah, she was terrific. We had her on the show. She was so much fun. So, Carolyn, mm-hmm. I mean, I could sit here the rest of the afternoon and yak with you, but I'm going to let you go make some more money and service some more clients. Tell our audience a little bit of how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up and where they can find you in the future.
So if you want any more information about me, you can just visit my blog at myshingle.com. If you want, also on Twitter at Carolyn Elefant or carolyn.elefant@gmail.com.
Okay, we'll have all those links in the show notes. Just one quick question. Are you handling all this yourself? You do all your social media posting and the writing, or do you have a little bit of help?
So most of the writing I do by myself. I've had an assistant, a virtual assistant, for 10 years now, and she over time has really come up to speed on a lot of text. So she does, I'll like write the posts and she'll post them. And sometimes I'll have like my summer associates do it. I just hired a recent college graduate who's going to help, you know, do some of the lawyer profiles that I do with the site and maybe help with, you know, creating some more content and doing some more social media management for the blog.
Great. Sounds like a winner. And it has been for a lot of years. And I wish you much continued success. And I'd love to have you back on the show some point in the future.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I enjoy listening to this podcast, and it's, you know, I think it's probably the first one that dealt with these issues. So, you know, good luck continuing it.
Thanks ever so much. And I appreciate you being on The Law Entrepreneur. Once again, I'd like to thank our sponsors for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur and welcome our newest sponsor, Ruby Receptionists. They, along with our old friends at Spotlight Branding, as well as Market Circle, the makers of Daylight, are the ones that make this podcast possible. And for them, I am very grateful. So please be sure to visit their websites. You can find the locations in the show notes for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. Or you can go to our website, thelawentrepreneur.com, and navigate to the resources page, and there you can find a way to get to each of their websites. So please visit their websites, sign on as clients. I'm a client now of all three, and I think you'll be happy you did so. So that's Ruby Receptionists, Spotlight Branding, and Market Circle, the makers of Daylight.